from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The drones are coming. They've already come to Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, wherever the U.S. military sees a threat. Now, the big buzz is much closer to home. Cheap, lightweight, high-capacity private drones that many predict will soon blanket the USA, checking crops, traffic, pipelines, picnic spots, maybe checking you. Our skies, says one big player, will be dark with drones. This hour on Point, the drones come home. You can join the conversation. Are you a drone fanatic, drone phobic, already launching your own unmanned aerial vehicle, or hiding under your desk? Where are we headed here? Here's a little drone sound for you. Just a little from a user review of a drone purchased from HoverThings.com. This particular model called the White Spy, made by Ready to Fly Quads. And there are all kinds of drones out there. Joining me first today from Berkeley, California is Chris Anderson, CEO of 3D Robotics, creator of DIYDrones.com, former editor-in-chief of Wired magazine, now a big-time booster, builder, and seller of drones. Chris Anderson, welcome to On Point.
Thanks. Good beer.
Yeah, you're the guy we're quoting here. The sky is going to be dark with these things. What's coming, Chris?
Well, I think that may be possibly a biblical reference. I'm not sure. But the point is that they're getting very cheap, small, light, and we're going to find new applications. So it's a little bit like the personal computer was to the mainframe, that, you know, when the, you know, 1977, when Apple released the Apple II and became, you know, the concept of desktop and personal computers came in. We, you know, Bill Gates and others at the time envisioned a day when someday we would all have one. And today, not only do we all have those, but they're in our pockets and beyond. And I think drones are following the same trajectory.
So what are we talking about here? When people think of drones, the first thing they're probably thinking is the image of a Predator or Reaper or one of these great big military things, you know, guided remotely out of somewhere in New Mexico and armed with missiles. But you're talking about a different genre of drones. Give us the sort of range of things you're talking about, Chris.
Exactly. I mean, I think people are thinking sort of the mainframe analogy, which is the big military ones. But the reality is that a drone is just an unmanned aircraft. Pretty much, it can be as small as, you know, the toys you can buy in the department store, little radio control helicopters and such. But unlike those, it's capable of autonomy, which is to say it flies by itself. It can follow GPS waypoints and conduct a mission. So although many of them can be flown, they don't have to be. Instead, you give them a job to do, and they go off and do them. You know, today, you know, mostly thanks again to you know, Silicon Valley technology, like that's the stuff that's in your smartphone already. There's just been an extraordinary advance in sensors and GPS and cameras and processors, and, you know, our iPhones and Android phones are just miracles of Moore's law, and those same components have made it possible to make drones that now cost hundreds of dollars, not millions.
Hundreds of dollars for a drone that could do what kind of thing? I mean, for many years, there's a big field at the end of my street, and, you know, amateur folks would be out there on the weekends sometimes with their little planes and their radio control, having them go in loops. They looked fun, but not really functional. What kind of tasks could be done by these, Chris?
Take those same planes and helicopters and add two things to them. One is an autopilot, which is a little box. We sell one called APM. Ours costs $179. And the other is a camera. And, you know, cameras can be anything. It could be, a GoPro camera, which is a popular, very high-definition, robust one, or just any old point-and-shoot you have. Put the two together, and now you've turned that remote control aircraft into a functioning drone. Now, why would you do that? And the answer is, well, we've sort of seen cameras go everywhere already. You know, the camera phone has sort of extended cameras into every aspect of the terrestrial space. But there's a lot of opportunity to take them into the air as well. I mean, GoPros are a great example. They're often used for sports, videoing. And, you know, sometimes the aerial shot is the right shot for skiing or waterboarding or whatever, other kind of sports. You know, we know this because when we watch professional sports, we can see how useful it is to get the camera, you know, the overhead view for NFL football games and beyond. You know, why couldn't we all have access to that kind of, you know, image perspective? And the answer is, with a drone, you can. That's the sort of the fun, you know, hobby, reason. then there's a ton of commercial uses. I mean, one of the ones people rarely think about is agriculture. You know, farmers are desperate to have more information about their crops, especially that overhead view, but the Google satellite only comes by, you know, once a year and, you know, at very low resolution. What if you could have, you know, aerial crop surveys every morning, just automatically done by a small drone? We already see crop dusters flying over farms. You know, why not small drones as well?
So cameras as the number one tool of the drone, is that the idea here? I mean, I've seen video. We've got it at our website, out of UPenn. They've got a drone that flies over. It can sort of swoop down like an eagle, snatch something, grab something, and take off. Is that out there too, or is it really the eye in the sky idea, kind of surveillance?
Right now, it's primarily cameras of various sorts. There's just so much information and useful stuff you can get out of cameras that we haven't spent a lot of time focused on the other aspects. I mean, obviously, there are things like scientific sensing, you know, air quality, things like that. And also, there's image sensors that go beyond the visual spectrum, do things like infrared to look at, for example, plants at night or insects that come out at night. But by and large, it's mostly cameras. The UPenn example you quoted from the Grasp Lab there, mm-hmm. where something grabs. That actually is only done in a laboratory context. It works in what's called a motion capture room, with a very, very expensive set of cameras, and it's basically the room is flying that. Doesn't know its own orientation in space. That sort of accuracy is just not possible outside in the real world, simply because because GPS is just not as accurate as those motion capture rooms are.
Autopilot, you point to, that means software. So I'm not sitting on the ground or at a laptop, sort of steering this thing, piloting it. It's got a task that what I'm saying, I want you to fly this grid or fly this circumference and show me what you see?
Precisely. So you can fly it if you want, but you don't have to. Typically what you would do is you would open up a laptop, or typically these days it might be something like an iPad or a phone or tablet, and you'd have a map of the area, and you would either draw lines to sort of say this is the area I want you to survey, or you would just click on the map at certain points. Those are called waypoints. And the waypoints are then have tasks associated. You know, take a picture here, or what's called loiter here, which is a circle, or look at a region of interest, or follow, something. Now, right now, the military drones follow by, tracking with a camera. The drones we're talking about for a few $100 would typically track another device, like a box you would have on your belt, so called a follow me box. But it's the same sort of thing. You sort of tell it what you want it to do, and then you let it figure out by itself how to get there and do all the kind of, the manual flying elements.
So I'm reading here about, yes, as you say, farmers may use this, already using it, to look at their crops. Pipeline inspections, much easier and safer here than with a helicopter. Following traffic, I guess, an obvious thing. I guess we can think of, inspecting trains even while they're on the track to see that everything's working all right. We can see all of those. But when you start talking, programs that help them loiter and circle over regions of interest, I'm sure I've got listeners thinking, well, then person of interest and then the privacy question. What about that, Chris? I mean, we're accustomed to looking up at the sky and thinking, that's the clear blue sky. You know, it may be mayhem all around me, but I look up and it's open and free. And from there, I'm not that spied upon. Is this an era of being spied upon? Is that what comes with this?
It's a legitimate concern, and a couple things that, just to put it in context. First of all, the vast majority of the drones that are out there in the United States right now are amateur. They're being flown by hobbyists and in recreational use. As a matter of fact, commercial use is not permitted in the United States without a special process that's quite hard to get through the FAA. So most of it's being done for fun. Also, those same regulations that require you at the moment to fly recreationally don't allow you to fly over built-up areas. So, people are not allowed to fly over your house, and not allowed to fly over the cities. You're supposed to be flying over parks and wooded areas and the like. Also under 400 feet and within visual line of sight. The scary scenarios that most people think about are ones where the police or the military or government uses these to track us. And what's interesting is that they're actually one of the most regulated entities in the United States. Right now, many communities, I think it's 50 communities at this point, cities and towns, are trying to put in place anti-drone legislation for exactly this reason. And one of the problems they're discovering is that there's a jurisdictional paradox, which is to say privacy in the United States is typically regulated on a local basis based on what's called a community standard reasonable expectation of privacy, and that varies from town to town. But the skies are regulated by the federal government, by the FAA. And so typically towns don't have jurisdiction over their own skies and can't control what's being done over there. What they can control is the actions of their own employees, such as their police. And so typically the police are the ones who are most, you know, most restricted and under the most scrutiny, and may in fact be one of the last to use drones, whereas you find commercial use, especially away from built-up areas, being the first.
Though fire departments looking at these to go out and see what's burning, and a lot of pressure. I'm reading about the meeting just, in the last few days outside of Washington, sort of drone industry people saying, release us to go out and use these things. But fears there that drones still maneuver poorly, have alarming crash rates, are spoofable, don't have the sensing capacity to spot approaching aircraft, quoting your former publication Wired here. Chris, we've got a lot of questions. Please stand by there. Here's a little sound drone video posted by Chris Anderson's DIYDrones.com just last month, a quad foo model at the park. Listeners, we're talking about the exploding age of drones in our own backyard, privately owned drones, beyond military, beyond police, and how they will be used. Do you see the drone age opening up around us? Will everybody, lots of people, have one? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about the exploding age of drones in our own backyard, privately owned drones, beyond military, beyond police, and how they'll be used. The sound behind me right there of a drone demo from microdrones.com. You see it hovering outside, then it flies through a doorway into a hallway. We're in new territory here, ladies and gentlemen, and the expectation is that drones are really taking off. My guest, Chris Anderson, is with us, former editor-in-chief of Wired magazine. Now he's all about drones, creator of DIYDrones.com, CEO of 3D Robotics. They build and sell and boost drones, quoted in the New York Times recently saying, the sky's going to be dark with these things. Maybe that's a biblical allusion, but the FAA is saying 30,000 or more in American skies by 2020, maybe a lot more. Big hearings today in Washington, the Senate Committee on the Judiciary looking at drones, the future of drones in America, the hearing today, law enforcement and privacy considerations. Rand Paul, Kentucky Republican senator, made a lot of drones earlier this month when he filibustered the nomination of John Brennan to be President Obama's CIA chief, all about trying to draw out American government's drone policy, particularly on death by drone, on drones used to kill. Here's a little bit of that, the Rand Paul filibuster.
I've come here to filibuster the nomination of John Brennan because I think the Fifth Amendment is important. But I think we shouldn't be cavalier. I don't think we should be casual in our disregard for the Constitution.
Don't be cavalier. Don't be casual. Here comes a new age, and the drones keep taking off. Here's a Parrot AR drone about a foot long. You hear it starting up and taking off. Maybe headed to a sky near you. Chris Anderson is with us from Berkeley, California. With us now from Grand Forks, North Dakota, an emerging drone industry center, is Tom Kenville, chairman and founder of Unmanned Applications Institute International. Its trade group supports the development of unmanned aircraft in North Dakota. He's also VP of Development at the Center for Innovation at the University of North Dakota. Years of experience in pilot training. The former governor of North Dakota, John Hoeven, tapped him to bring the drone business to their state. Tom Kenville, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me, Tom. You can call me Tommy so we keep each other straight, okay?
Okay, Tommy. Are drones going to be a big deal? Non-governmental drones, private, maybe even more commercial drones one day?
We view this as a very growing market. We need the United States to stay on the leading edge. Other countries are ahead of us today with drone development. I don't like the word drones either. I like remotely piloted vehicles, ground, air, and sea. The aircraft gets a lot more coverage, but we have these vehicles on the ground, in the air, and at sea. So It's exciting, and I think agriculture, especially for crop analysis, use less pesticides. We could do looking for missing people, volunteer firemen, like you mentioned earlier. These things go from a couple pounds to up to 25 pounds that you don't actually need an airport or a runway, and then you get the larger ones that we obviously get a lot of press about that, and a lot of research needs to be done, but it's exciting. It's exciting, the opportunities. So
the FAA is talking about 30,000 of these in American skies by 2020. Does that number sound about right to you? High, low? What do you think, Tommy?
It sounds high, you know, and the other thing we don't talk about much is training and education and research, right? So we're not just going to go to the store, buy one, and take off and fly it. I think that we're going to need everybody will need a little bit of training and what are your restrictions and what you can do with them. And I think that they'll be safely operated. You know, we'll have no different than manned aircraft. You know, the airliners we get on aren't military airliners, but aviation really got its boom in the military and transitioned to civilian use. So I think that we will have a great number of them, it'll help save lives and save money and double the size of aviation in the world. So
Chris Anderson was reminding us earlier that they are currently not permitted, strictly speaking, for commercial use. What does that mean, and how do you see that policy evolving, Tommy?
Well, right now, like the state of North Dakota has an airspace integration team. We have one voice of where we want to test for the FAA, and the FAA is going to pick six test sites around the country to do the research to make sure it is safe, to make sure we do know what we're doing.
But I'm asking about commercial use more widely, and I can see the industry already pushing for this. I mean, the joke was the taco copter that would deliver with the GPS, deliver you a taco, you know, from the sky wherever, whenever you wanted it. I guess that would, technically speaking, be prohibited under current law. But do you think that'll change?
I do, but it'll take again some research and training. Commercial use by the FAA standard is for hire. Okay, so today you can go bring me a taco as long as you don't charge me for the taco or the flight. It's legal for you to bring me a taco with your UAV. But if you charge me for the flight or the taco, it's illegal. So the same thing has happened. It's just if there was a funds changing hands. Again, back to the training, I think it's critical that we have training with restrictions, and we do this quickly as a government and get into the air, but we also do it safely. You
know? And what about the privacy question? Is this the end of topless sunbathing in our backyards? Everybody can have one up in the sky with a camera, as Chris Anderson says, and vertical privacy finished?
Well, I hope not. You know, I don't mind the topless bathing situation, but the fact is I can already take pictures of that with my iPad, almost with my car, with my cell phone. I think the privacy issue has to be a lot broader than just drones. And there's cameras everywhere right now.
Yeah, but I don't expect one to be above me when I'm on the blanket in the backyard.
Well, how do you know it already isn't on the light pole above your fence in the backyard? How do you know? And so that's what I'm saying, and there are cameras everywhere. The drone is just a vehicle.
It's kind of a thin comfort when you put it that way, kind of thin. But let's hold the thought for a second. Tommy, Chris Anderson, we've got lots of callers. Ben in Shelburne, Vermont. Ben, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm fine. What's your experience?
I just purchased a UAV about a month ago, and the ideas that you can use with it just keep unfolding and unfolding. I mean, I planned on using it just for high-end realty, to realtors to take pictures from above.
What, are you a photographer, Ben? Are you a photographer?
I'd say I'm an amateur photographer, but...
So you wanted to put it up in the sky and take that kind of aerial photo of the house or the home place that farmers have bought for years and others. What else are you going to do with it? What else do you do with it?
The other idea that we've been tossing up is you can also get goggles so that you can actually see exactly what the machine is seeing or from the camera. And it's called an FPV or first-person view. And we'd like to go to concerts if we could, and charge $10 for 10-minute flight, and you just sit somebody down, and you can actually fly over the concert and give them completely different views and angles that they would never get before.
Now, that would literally be like being high at the concert, like the sky view.
Well, might as well be a drag. You might as well be a dragonfly. Is pretty much what you could be, and just fly about. Fly about the concert and see different views.
The imagination rises and reels. It's wonderful, Ben. We'll see where that goes. The goggles. Ed in Mount Pleasant, Iowa. Ed, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My concern is the farmer who's surveying his field, and you're driving down the interstate. The drone gets loose and hits your windshield. You go in the ditch, and then how he's going to sort that out?
Good question. Chris Anderson, what about liability and drones? How's it work?
Yeah, it is a good question, and the simple answer is that it falls under the usual categories of product liability and all that. I mean, typically these things are quite small, and the FAA class that's probably going to be the first to deregulate is probably going to be under 400 pounds. Ideally, these things are made of foam. Typically, in the in crops, you might have a small aircraft, an airplane, fixed wing airplane. It'll just bounce off the window. It wouldn't hurt. Now, a copter.
I'm not persuaded, Chris. I got to tell you. I mean, a deer. A 100-pound deer coming through the windshield is a problem. A 400-pound drone. I'm not sure about this bouncing theory.
Four pounds. Under 4 pounds. It's typically 2 pounds.
Okay.
They're made of foam. I was actually a little surprised by Tommy's comment earlier that he thought the 30,000 number was high. We think there's 30,000 drones in the U.S. airspace right now, and you can, as the previous caller said, you can buy them in a hobby shop. So I'd love to get if you could ask Tommy to clarify what he means by drone, because we look at our sales right now. We sell in the United States. We're selling 10,000 a year.
10,000 a year just from your company, and of course there are many. Yeah. There are many more companies. Tommy, maybe there's a definition issue here. Chris Anderson's pretty broad in his definition of a drone or a UAV here. How do you define it? If you think it's maybe 30,000 by 2020?
He's correct. I look at what's been out there today. A majority of being remotely controlled aircraft are hobby because they're not for commercial use. So my point was more toward in the future. Commercial users, the number, but I'm sure there is that many remotely controlled already out there.
And Chris, when you say 2 to 4 pounds, I'm looking at a lot of these smaller drones right now that weigh more than that. It's not hard to find a 25-pound drone. If I'm a farmer and I want one that's going to go up and down, over a big farm, it's really going to be just 2 pounds. Aren't there plenty that are larger?
It depends on the size of the farm. Typically, for a larger farm, you'd want a plane rather than a copter because they have longer duration. And so, what's recommended is something called a flying wing. It's basically a foam, sort of a strip of foam. It's about typically 3 or 4 feet long. Weighs about 2.5-3 pounds when all the stuff is in together. It has an electric motor and a camera, and just flies itself. It does what's called a lawnmower pattern. It's quite great. It flies quite low. It's very quiet, and it's the kind of thing that literally would bounce off a window if it hit. For smaller farms, you might use what's called a multicopter, which is 4 or 6 or 8 blades, a quad or a hex or an octocopter. And those things are not made out of foam. They are more dangerous because they do have those spinning blades. But they tend to be small. You try to keep them under that 4 pound. Regulatory minimum, and they fly quite slowly and not very far. So, absolutely, people have to be careful about these. Absolutely, things can go wrong. But the great thing about farms is that, by and large, it's private land. By and large, it's away from built-up areas and people. There's very few obstructions. It's flat. You can stay within visual line of sight. And so it's a lot less risky than what your previous caller mentioned, for example, like flying one of these over a concert crowd, which is not only illegal at the moment, but I think potentially unsafe. And as fun as that sounds, I would not feel comfortable doing that myself, and I would not recommend that people do it.
Okay, but Ben may be out there launching his goggle flight already. We're talking about the exploding age of drones. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tommy, I'm still thinking about our Iowa caller's question about that drone on the loose that whacks into the windshield, or, you got the top down and it bonks you in the forehead. Are drone owners, Chris talked about product liability insurance, but what about the drone owner, the farmer? Is he required to carry special insurance if he's going to put a drone up in the sky in case something goes wrong?
Most likely. All equipment, whether he gets hit by a 3 pound drone or a 30 pound goose, we don't want him to get hit either way, right? But things happen. And so you try to minimize the liability. I'm sure there'll be some insurance that'll be involved in this as the industry progresses. But they're also, we've proven that technology is safer than people, right? I mean, a lot of airplanes are fly-by-wire right now, manned airplanes. So I think we can minimize the risk by the programming of the technology, and that's why we need to get into the air and test and research and the training. I keep getting back to training, but there should be emergency procedures so that we minimize that chance of that happening.
But I mean, you talk about passenger aircraft. I mean, they've got flight towers and trained pilots and all the rest. Here's a question: William James from Missouri says, "Do these drones have to have and register a flight plan?" I'm reading here in a story saying, the FAA, I mean, there's this issue of how to avoid mid-air collisions. The operator on the ground can't see other traffic in the air. The FAA plans to have a system ready by 2015, I'm reading, called Sense and Avoid, in which each plane in the sky, manned or unmanned, uses GPS equipment to locate itself, sends the information to a computer on the ground, draws a map showing all, everything else is flying around there. How do we keep these from turning into a crash derby in the sky, Chris?
The FAA works on a stratification policy, which is they have different classes of airspace at different altitudes. So right now what they do is the stuff that we fly, which is, autonomously guided recreational drones, fly under 400 feet and within visual line of sight, which means basically it's sort of a half mile or so in every direction and away from built-up areas and airports. Manned aircraft, on the other hand, start at about 1,000 feet and go up. And so there's this big buffer zone of more than 600 feet, where the two are, the two just would not be in the space at the same time. And that's because, exactly as you said, the drones don't have sense and avoid. The important thing about the FAA's control of the airspace is safety. And you need to make sure that, A, that, you can see if there's any obstructions or anything you might collide with, and B, you can do something about it with a pilot in command.
But you're talking about autonomous drones. I mean, this isn't going to stay within visual eye contact. That just doesn't jive with your description of software-powered, GPS-informed, autonomous flight. That's going to get way outside what you can see, quick as a wink.
Technically, it can. Although, that if you let it happen, and if you're the pilot or you're the commander, then you violate the law. And at that point, it's always possible to use technology for ill and to break the law. And you can use your computer to write a poem or write a computer virus. And if you write the computer virus, we'll prosecute that. So I think what we have is an obligation here for the regulatory authorities to put in place an enforcement mechanism and to ensure that people do comply with the laws that are already in place. Because I think they actually are sensible, and certification or licensing process, maybe like a driver's license, would probably be a good way to keep track of these things better.
Big concerns being raised about all this. Looking here at the U.S., Congressman Ed Markey, co-chairs the Congressional Privacy Caucus, saying this week, as drones increasingly fill our skies, Americans must be afforded a level of privacy and protection from these aerial technologies. People worried about it to ensure that this sort of big boom doesn't just get out of control and get going. I mean, Tommy, do we need to write laws now so that as this takes off, we're fully covered? Are we really fully covered with what's out there in terms of law already, given what's coming, changing?
Well, first I'd like to back up a little bit, Tom, and finish out Chris, as he talked about the small ones. The larger UAVs will file flight plans, will have sense and avoid equipment on them, will have technology so we can see them. But the testing still needs to be done on the maneuvers and procedures if they have an issue of another manned aircraft or another drone in the sky. What are the procedures to avoid a crash?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about the exploding age of drones in our own backyard, privately owned drones, beyond military, beyond police, and how they will be used. Behind us right there, a little group of robotics researchers at the University of Pennsylvania recently demonstrating a swarm of tiny drones, nano quad rotors, all kinds of drone stuff going on. Here's more. The sound of micro drone quad rotor about the size of your hand. Okay, the size of your hand. You're going to hear that over your cornfield, over your backyard. Tom Kenville. Tommy Kenville is with us from Grand Forks, North Dakota. It's drone country these days, and he's had a lot to do with promoting that. He's looking forward to training a new generation of drone users, but all kinds of people are getting into this. He's chairman and founder of the Unmanned Applications Institute International there in Grand Forks. We'll hear in just a moment from the ACLU and their concerns about privacy when it comes to drones. Tommy, we had to cut you off there in the middle of looking at, I guess, the law and whether we need to, you know, bulk it up to prepare for what's coming.
Well, we have a summit coming May 30 and 31st, the researchcorridor.com, and that's going to be one of the topics. I don't think we need any new laws right now, but we have to monitor. I'm like anyone, totally respect my privacy. However, we also have to continue this technology and take it where it can go. So we have to be cognizant of privacy and laws. On the same token, we have to make progress. So at this time, I don't think we need new laws. I think we have our constitutional laws are already in place that guards us for privacy. You know, I can't look in your window, Tom. It doesn't matter how I get there, whether I walk there, fly there, drive there. It's against the law. So, but I think we do have to stay on top of it and watch it so that you know, our citizens and privacy is protected. But I just don't think it needs to be. We don't need laws before we have roads, you know.
Well, maybe, though it's open sky up there. I mean, I guess you're in the biz of boosting and doing it responsibly. Ed Markey again in Congress saying, you know, we may need more, to ensure that strong personal privacy protections and transparency measures are put in place now before this technology is literally hovering over our heads. Maybe a little late for that. It's up there. Jay Stanley with the ACLU joins us in just a moment. A couple of calls first. Tom in Manchester, Connecticut. Tom, you're on the air.
Howdy.
Hi.
Hi, I was wondering, what if you took a payload of gasoline on it, flew over the house of my ex, and smashed into her car when she gets on the road?
Now, Tom, take it easy, big boy.
Now, I have no intention of doing this. I certainly wouldn't broadcast it if I did.
Yeah.
But, I mean, laws have nothing to do with this.
So turn it into a weapon. A million ways to do that, I guess. Tommy Kenville, what about it? You get it up there. It's free to roll. My fence won't stop it. What do you say?
Well, again, if the equipment and products are used inappropriately, I mean, my cell phone can do as much damage to his ex-wife as a drone can.
How so? I mean, your cell phone can't carry...
You can send it in the mail and have it timely go off and explode. I mean, come on. So again, it's all in the hands. It's all in the training. It's all in the restrictions. But you know, ultimately, most anything. I mean, look at TSA these days. I mean, everything is a weapon. So
I mean, I take your point. But when it's flying over my house, I look at it a little differently. I want to get Jay Stanley in here with the ACLU, senior policy analyst, joining us from Washington. He's thought a lot about the coming age of drones in America. Jay Stanley, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
Okay, we count on you guys to be guardians of privacy and more. What are you looking at when you see the drone wave apparently coming at us?
Well, our biggest concern around drones has to do with law enforcement use. So I think there's a lot of pent-up demand for the use of surveillance drones by police departments across America. They've basically been blocked from using them by the FAA because of safety concerns. But the reins are being loosened. Congress has ordered the FAA to make it easier to deploy drones. So I think that is the number one concern that we have, especially that drones not be used for sort of persistent suspicionless mass surveillance.
The U.S. military does that all over the place. It would be easy to do it here, presumably.
As a technological matter, it would be very easy to do, and that's one of our concerns. I know we're focused today on sort of private sector use of drones, and there are privacy issues there as well, as you know we started to talk about. They could be used, you know, for peeping, buzzing up to your third floor bedroom window and looking in. They could be used for sort of persistent observation of your backyard or private property or persistent observation of public spaces. We could have live Street View or live Google Earth. They could be used for location
tracking. If you get enough of these up there, just watching all the time. Tommy Kenville and Chris Anderson both say, no, under current law already, you're protected from peeping Toms through your bedroom window or any other window. It's not allowed. What do you say, Jay?
That is true. There are peeping Tom laws in most states. They're inconsistent, and some of them are much stronger than others, and they should be unified. And that would take care of some of the privacy problems that drones could raise. But when you look forward to the future, I mean, I think right now, as you know, as has been said, we're in the early age. We're in like 1900 when with automobiles, where there's a few rickety hand cranked vehicles flying around, and we haven't needed as much rules and regulation as we will when, you know, Interstate 95 is jam-packed and you have very busy streets and everybody's doing it.
What about that? Just overflight rights. I mean, you know, now sometimes on a nice summer day, I'm a little annoyed if even just a passenger jet goes, you know, 20, 30,000 feet over if it's loud. I mean, is there anything to protect American citizens from someday in the future, maybe not too far, having junk whizzing all above their heads all the time in their own backyard?
Yeah, well, I mean, really, the law is pretty unclear on this. It used to be that under common law, when you owned land, you owned it all the way up to the heavens. But that was done away with in the aviation era, because otherwise, you know, flight would have been impossible.
Mm-hmm.
And so pretty much, you know, the Supreme Court has ruled that you don't have privacy rights from the air, at least from a police helicopter or airplane flying over. That could change with high technology. And at a certain point, if the drone is low enough, then trespass and nuisance law comes into play.
How low?
Well, it's not clear.
I mean, 6 feet?
6 feet, I would say that it's a pretty good bet.
12?
I mean,
it's interesting, though, how that gets raised. You've reminded us of this story of a guy who spent a couple $100 and built a paintball drone and flew it around, you know, shooting things with paintballs. Now, it's easy to imagine a different kind of gun on there, not a paintball gun. Is that a problem?
Yeah. I mean, one of the things about private drones is there's an enormous amount of innovation and tinkering that's going on, and Chris Anderson has been a leader in that, and a lot of ferment, and there's going to be a lot of really amazing new uses and clever things. And, you know, we're pro-technology, we're pro-innovation, we want to encourage that. But there will also be some scary things that come up. And I think that the guy who put a paintball gun on his drone and started shooting, you know, cut out wooden targets with it, and he has a video online, I wrote a blog about this, you know, I think that that is a reminder, and he did that as a reminder, that there is a dark side to these technologies. You know, we've called for regulation of police use of drones now to get ahead of the technology. But when it comes to the private use, we haven't called for any regulation because there are countervailing values when it comes to private use of drones. There are free speech issues that come in. Drones have, you know, have these kind of spooky uses with the paint guns and privacy invasion, but they also have a lot of good uses. We've seen them used at protests in Poland. The Occupy Wall Street protesters built an Occucopter. I don't think they actually deployed it.
To do what? How is it speech, flying a drone around?
Well, you know, one of the things that the ACLU has been involved in recent years is defending the right to photography. Police officers around the country have been arresting people, seizing cameras for photographing police operations. And we, you know, there's a pretty well-established First Amendment right to take photographs of things that are visible from public spaces where you have a right to be. And one of the questions is, how does that apply to drones?
So if Occupy, Wall Street is using a drone up in the sky to sort of film police interaction with their protest, you're calling that a free speech issue?
Yeah, I mean, the First Amendment, part of the purpose of the First Amendment is to allow individuals to monitor their government. We don't want, we don't want the government monitoring individuals without reasonable suspicion that they're, you know, involved in wrongdoing, sort of on a mass level. But we do want individuals to have the right to monitor the government. And drones are being used in journalism schools. There's a journalism program at the University of Nebraska, another one at the University of Missouri. They're experimenting with drones for reporting and story research. They've been used by anti-whaling activists. They've been used by environmental activists. So we need to be very careful in any rules mm-hmm. that we put in place on private drones to allow these good uses and this innovation while still preserving our privacy heritage.
Mm, so many listeners at our gates here. In a couple of years, they'll just be flying in with their questions, I guess. They're having the drone fly it over. Joe in Manchester, Connecticut. Joe, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Tom. Happy equinox.
Yeah, same to you. Spring. But what's that snow in my yard?
Same here from Manchester.
Yeah.
Anyway, your other callers and your guests have covered a couple points I wanted to talk about already, namely getting some ground rules for things like privacy and not abusing this new technology, as we've seen with personal phones, telephones with cameras built in, kids taking pictures of everything and then texting it wildly on Facebook. But other applications that are really positive for this stuff would be in search and rescue. When we got clobbered with heavy snow here in Connecticut, imagine a search and rescue drone being able to fly out, zero in on someone's 911 call, and drop off emergency medical supplies or what have you in remote hiking areas when you have threatening inclement weather out in resorts. Basically, okay, power up the drones. We want to be ready in case someone gets trapped out on the slopes. And you can then, you know, the drones take the place of the fabled St. Bernards of old.
You think they're going to come out with the barrel strapped under their chin? You might be right. Or just bring back the image that shows you in search and rescue where that person is. I mean, or you, if you can send out a swarm, you can see even just one. You can see a lot in a hurry. Joe, I'm sure many people are thinking along these lines as we talk about it here today, and I appreciate your call. We're looking at the exploding age of drones in our own backyard. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's go to Kit in Hanover, New Hampshire. Kit, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
So just wanted to go back to the safety aspect regarding manned aircraft. I'm a 32-year-long pilot, fly helicopters, and a comment was made earlier about the drones operating low altitude and not in the altitudes of larger manned aircraft. And I, as a pilot, already have encountered radio-controlled airplanes at the altitudes I fly at.
And what if one of those gets into one of your rotors, Kit?
Tail rotor in particular. I mean, you know, those are smaller, more fragile, and it would be catastrophic. And, you know, that's a huge concern.
Tommy Kenville, how do you put chopper pilot Kit's mind at ease here?
Well, again, through testing and research. I mean, he's got valid points. I've been working with pilots and training pilots for 25 years myself. I was with the University of North Dakota, who's a large flight school. They have one of the first UAV degrees in college in the country, and we have to train these UAV pilots. Another point we haven't covered closely is they have micro UAVs, mini UAVs, small, medium, and large, and the medium and large are going to be the main ones that need to be follow the rules of a regular pilot, I believe. The FAA hasn't come out with the ruling yet, but I think it'll be something close to that. And then the minis and micros and smalls, what are their rules and altitudes, and so that everyone can see everyone. And the aircraft that Kit flies now probably has a fancy GPS in it, and it could see a small aircraft if the right technology's on both airplanes. So,
and the FAA here again saying by 2015, not long from now, they want to have this sense and avoid sort of a general system for manned and unmanned vehicles in the sky. Kit, I appreciate your call. One more right here, Lawrence in Heartland, Vermont. Lawrence, you're on.
Hi, Tom. I've been following these things since about 2007 when I still lived in Europe. And there was there's a German group that developed the so-called multi-prop octocopters, hexacopters, and things like that.
Yeah.
And these make outstanding camera platforms. It's kind of frustrating to come over here now. I've had one for 3 years over here, but there's not much I can do with it except take pictures from the air, which I love to do, because the commercial aspects, of course, are forbidden by the FAA. And your other guest from the ACLU, Jace, addressed quite a few of these points, and I think in a reasonable way that people shouldn't be so afraid of them if they're used reasonably.
What do you want to do with them, Lawrence? You want to go photograph the Kardashians, or do you want to come after my swim party, or what?
I have exceptionally, one of the reasons I got involved in this, I also helped in the development of very, very high-resolution pocketable cameras from a company that uses a special sensor.
Yeah.
And just the B beauty of an aerial image is where it starts for me. I've been photographing for over 50 years, and it's just a beautiful thing to do.
Yes.
And obviously, you know, that's one aspect. Video is another one. You can take exceptional videos from up there on a stable platform. And this has been going on in Europe for a long time, and completely without regulation, by the way. They're far more deregulated in Europe than they are over, and than what they're talking about over here, and there's far less concern about it. The primary reason is that these things are not easy to fly. I don't care what people say about the skies turning black with them.
Yeah.
If they turn black with them, there's going to be a lot of crashes in the air. They are not easy to fly. They don't fly in bad weather. They don't fly when there's wind of any sort of velocity.
Lawrence, we've got it. My time is so short. Forgive me. I want to get it to Jay. Jay, you see the opportunity and the risk there, all the beauty and wonder of all that high-res still photography and video. I'm sure it can be great. At the same time, you know, the old-fashioned sense that under the clear blue sky, I should be somehow in my own private bubble. Is that going to go away, Jay?
Well, I think that there is a threat of that. I mean, I know that people in Hollywood are living in fear that tabloid journalists will darken the skies there, watching everybody's every move. And I think that we're all susceptible to that to some extent. And we're going to need to work through these issues and figure out how to protect the privacy we've always enjoyed while still allowing the cool uses of this exciting technology.
Jay Stanley with the ACLU in Washington. Thanks for joining us today, Jay.
Thank you so much.
And Tommy Kenville in Grand Forks, North Dakota. How's the industry going, Tommy, out there? Is it booming? Is it coming up?
It's progressing steady, safely, and not quite fast enough, just like your gentleman said. Europe and Israel and Canada, they're a long way ahead of us.
Tom Kenville, thanks so much. This is On Point.